Hey, I'm Brad, and I'm playing bingo at the Corner Bar in Bucktown, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 778, and what we do here on this program is, of course, take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. We are online on Twitter at Outside the Loop, on Facebook, on Instagram, on podcast platforms. You know, wherever you get your podcasts these days, you can get the podcast of this show for free. We'd love for you to do that. Or check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com for all of the audio archives over the years. And we say, hello to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer in the WGN Radio studios today, and Colin Seaman produces the show. Hi, Colin.
Hello, Mike. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. You know, we live in a beautiful city, don't we?
I think so. Yeah.
Well, according to Time Out, I didn't know this was a thing, Time Out Chicago, I think it's still Time Out Chicago. I don't know. There's a Time Out Empire now. According to this, what I'm seeing here, there was the most beautiful city list, and this was according to the Time Out Index survey. There were a bunch of votes, and Chicago came in second place.
Behind... There is it New York? It's always New York, right?
No, this is around the world.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Second place.
Yep.
It's the alleys, man.
It is the alleys. And to answer your question, who did we lose to? Prague.
Who put this together?
It was the Time Out Index survey, whatever that means. So it must be credible.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who are like really, they rave about Prague. I haven't been, so I guess I got to hold my reservations there. But hey, number two, second city, baby.
Second city. We're destined for it. Paris was number three. We also beat out Amsterdam and Vienna. I mean, okay. I'll take it. I don't know exactly, you know, what specifically, but yeah, you know what? I'm going to go with the alley system.
The city knows how to look nice. I think that's always been the case, whether it's the alleys or the strategic green places placed throughout. I think that's always been, I don't know, you were here when they like did the thing with the airport, right? The former airport.
They did the thing with the former Migs Field.
Yeah. Where it just kind of got,
oh
like,
yeah. When they destroyed it. Sure. Sure. Yeah.
Tore up in the middle of the night.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
That was, yeah. It's that kind of
daily.
It's that kind of gumption that, and I don't know what it is. I'm going to use the word gumption, but it's that kind of stuff that puts the right foot forward and makes us show well, Mike.
Just destroying airports on a whim, you know, it's all good. Although I do like the venue that they turned it into. It is cool over there. It's pretty to go see a show. It's pretty nice. But I like, you know, I also find the beauty in like the back porches. I always find the alleys and like the behinds of like the apartment buildings, that network of like porches, maybe some back patios, but those mm-hmm. wooden porches. I think that's really cool and a really interesting sort of community back there. So I think that's pretty. We can celebrate the alleys. We can celebrate the porches. We can't celebrate the rats, or can we?
Well, we lead in that, right?
I think we're
number one.
I think we might be. We might
at least
be
in
number
the
one there.
States.
Yeah. Yeah. With our rat issue.
You can't win them all. You can get close. In fact, second in the world. So let's hang our hat on that.
The reputable Time Out Index survey, still trying to figure out what that is, but hey, I'll take it. We're beautiful. Everyone's beautiful. You're beautiful. The show is beautiful. We have a beautiful show today, don't we?
Absolutely. I think we should get to it.
Let's get to it. This is Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven, and you are beautiful. There is such a rich literary scene here in Chicago, if you know where to look. Quimby's Bookstore at 1854 West North Avenue in the Wicker Park, Bucktown area is home to unusual publications, independent zines, comics, and other items you can't find anywhere else. This month, Quimby's turns 30, which is awesome. And Liz Mason is the manager at Quimby's Bookstore. She has been there since 2001. You can check them out online, quimbys.com. Liz, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You are quite welcome. So Quimby's is such a cool place, and I think just now a staple in the community, especially the literary community. Briefly, if you can, just tell us how this all got started 30 years ago.
Yeah, so the original owner, Stephen Simbersky, moved from Boston to Chicago and opened Quimby's at 1328 North Damon, right at Damon and Evergreen. And then he ran the store for some years and then decided he was going to move to Amsterdam. And then he sold it to Eric Kersimer, who's the current owner, who also owns Chicago Comics, which is up in Lakeview. And then in the late 90s, we moved to where we are now, over on North Avenue. And our mission has always been to carry small press periodicals, independently published zines, and other type of aberrant reading material.
I love the mission. I mean, there are all kinds of things you can find inside of Quimby's. And you mentioned zines, and I think that's worth calling out because maybe some of us listening, we might not know what a zine is. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, so the short answer is it's an independently published periodical. That can mean a lot of different things, but the typical characteristics of a zine are little to no advertising or not a lot of advertising, a small distribution radius, which really just means a small readership. Maybe they only print at most a couple hundred copies, isn't typically very glossy, is often stapled and is usually covering topics that are a little bit more idiosyncratic and typically not found in the mainstream.
And I think it's great because, I mean, Quimby's, like we're talking about here, is definitely an outlet for zines, these self-published magazines. It's possible to get your message and your work out there, and you don't have to go through sort of the big-time publishers. And there's definitely a community for that.
Definitely. A lot of the people who publish zines are people doing it with their own resources by themselves or maybe with, you know, a few friends. And we're happy to sell it for them. All they have to do is bring it in or send it to us and fill out our consignment form, and they designate the retail price. And then once something sells, they get 60% of their retail price, and we'll take it almost no questions asked, as long as it, you know, retails under a certain price and some other logistical considerations. We're happy to do a little bit of paperwork and put it out on our floor to sell and to help get the word out about the thing that they're creating.
I think that's so cool because this consignment model allows local authors and artists and creatives to come to you and say, hey, I've got some stuff I'd love to put out there. And then you're able to do that. So you're able to showcase a lot of, you know, local talent that, let's be honest, sometimes it's difficult when you're doing something like this. If you're publishing, it's difficult to get your message, your work out there. So I know a lot of artists and writers just love to go to Quimby's because it's a great outlet for their work.
Yeah, it's true. We definitely, because we have the consignment model, we don't have to pay for stuff up front. We wait until after it sells. So it allows us to not have to do the hard sell. Like, basically, you know, we just have a little bit of labor on the front end of it and are able to put that stuff out there without feeling like, oh, we've already bought this stuff wholesale. We got to, like, do the used car salesperson thing of, you know, jamming it down someone's throat. You know, like, it's really nice to be able to just be like, you know what? I haven't read this. Could be awesome. Could be not awesome. I don't know. But happy to put it out there for other people to come in and take a look at it. And I should mention also that we have stuff from all over the world. So it's not just local folks, although there is a pretty abundant independent publishing community in Chicago and the surrounding areas. But we also have stuff from overseas and international, and we're happy to carry that stuff.
I love that because I think that that kind of media, right, that's independent and yeah, local and beyond, but, you know, local to other communities as well. I mean, it really tells the story, or at least a more complete story, of who we are as a people, because you know, we're not all reading sort of the same few big time publications. There's more of an opportunity. I guess it spreads that that democracy around a little bit so people can tell their own stories.
Definitely. It is, I think, also a good sort of journalistic overview of what kind of happened during the pandemic, because a lot of people took to that time that they were at home, if they were the type of people that were working from home or unemployed at home, to do a lot of journaling and publishing about their experience during the quarantine. And because of that, a whole genre of zines and mini comics and chapbooks was born called the Quarantine.
And
I think that it really is a thoughtful way of, we're going to look back on this in many years and use kind of the zines that people published at that time, being like, all right, so there were the things that people were publishing online, there were the books that were written, but there were also those very sort of personal written words published. And I think it's going to be a great resource.
And that's really important, again, to tell a more complete history of what we're going through right now with this pandemic, which we hope is a once-in-a-lifetime deal. And so we want to tell that story for future generations and to have these other voices, this variety of voices out there who are able to publish the Quarantine, as you're saying. I think that's really wonderful. And that kind of leads into my next question. When we talk about the state of alternative media, and we can keep it locally here, you said a lot of folks were doing this during the lockdown quarantine situation, during the pandemic. But where are we? I mean, how are things looking when we survey that alternative media landscape in Chicago?
Well, it always feels prolifically represented to me because I live in a little independent publishing bubble where literally it comes addressed to the store address where I work. And so I see the stack of mail come in every day. You know, like every day stuff comes in from all over. It's like Christmas. We have our consignment form on our website. So, you know, you could print it out and send us your zines. It's totally unsolicited. We don't know that it's coming. And so we're checking it in every day. And so people who say like zines faded out, now they're having a resurgence. Like in my mind, it's like, don't call it a comeback. Like, you know, like literally zines have been here for years. And just because one person has kind of faded away from paying attention to it doesn't mean that it wasn't still there. It definitely feels like every day people are locally even are dropping stuff off. And we never feel like we're totally caught up in putting all the stuff in the computer that we need to put in because we get so much stuff.
Well, there are all kinds of things that you can pick up at Quimby's. And we should, again, mention the website, quimbys.com. You can submit items. You can certainly browse what Quimby's has. And go check them out, 1854 West North Avenue in Chicago. Liz Mason is the manager at Quimby's Bookstore. Happy 30th anniversary. This is so cool, Liz. And here's to 30 more. And thanks for all that you do.
Oh, thank you.
In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Oh yes, dialing up across town, connecting to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave, with The Secret History of Chicago Music. And Steve, this is kind of new territory, as you say in your piece. We're getting jazzy today, but jazz violin? What the what?
We're going into like old new territory or new old territory or something here. Yeah, sort of a lost art. The sort of like almost gypsy style jazz violin. Not something you hear, I don't know, you know, maybe there's constantly revivals of these sort of old timey kinds of music. So maybe there is and I just don't know about it. But you don't hear too much these days.
You do not, although I've heard of this gentleman. We are talking about Johnny Frigo. And he is an awesome, just, you call him a Renaissance man. He really is. I mean, he lived quite the life. And maybe if you are into jazz, you've heard of good old Johnny Frigo as this really just amazing jazz violinist. Wasn't the only thing he played. He played a few other instruments, but let's learn the story of him. So he was born on the South Side in 1916. So we're going back a little ways here.
Yeah, sort of a local legend that I feel like people would possibly have heard of. He was even playing at the Green Mill towards like the end of his life in the aughts, you know. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I think people might know him around here. And he is Chicago born and bred, born on the South Side. And, yeah, as you said, 1916. And I guess, you know, one of those self-made dudes who sort of came from absolutely nothing, I guess from a very poor family. They could barely afford the quarter it cost to get him lessons, I guess. He was like a junk picker and like a rag boy. You wow. know, like I guess a rag man, and then you had a rag boy. He was going around, you know, like another thing you don't hear about too much these days. He was so poor, and I guess like the ragman's son is the one who gave him the lessons along with the ragman's son. So definitely, you know, tales of poor immigrants sort of coming up in Chicago.
That's right. Born to an Italian immigrant family in the Roseland neighborhood again in 1916. So he's coming up, and as he's getting older, he's taking music lessons, and I believe he picks up the violin around age 7. And there's a quote somewhere in what you wrote. You know, he was saying, oh, everyone was outside playing baseball and I was stuck inside taking violin lessons when I was a kid. But I guess it paid off down the road.
It did. And, you know, and I think he had an inclination towards it. I have a feeling even at age 7, he was probably rocking that thing pretty hard. But, you know, I feel like adversity struck. I mean, so he finally gets to school where, you know, he can actually study a musical instrument for free, and they don't even have violin for him. So he had to sort of do it in his spare time, and he had to take up the tuba, I guess, because basically no one else wanted it, you know?
Right.
So, and yeah, and he played bass as well. He, stand-up bass, I have a feeling he was probably one of those guys who was just like an all around amazing musician and could probably play anything. I say this not being one of those guys, you know, like yeah. I need a stringed thing in my hand. Maybe I can do something on it. Otherwise, nothing. So I just have a feeling he probably was a pretty killer musician from the get go.
From the early age. I mean, he was playing with some names, or I guess names that would be famous one day. He's played with some great people.
Yeah, I mean, by like age 18, he's pretty much out playing professionally. And yeah, he played with Albert Ammons, you know, this sort of legendary, one of the absolute forefathers of like blues, boogie-woogie kind of piano. When he was like 18 or something like that, you know? So, and I think those are, again, in the days when, you know, people were just more open sort of instrumentation, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think of a violin throwing down on a session with him, but he could do, I guess he could have been on bass as well.
Yeah. In 1942, he played with Chico Marx of the Marx Brothers. And he was also in a quartet with a 17-year-old Mel Torme.
It's pretty, I mean, I'm a massive Marx Brothers fan, so basically when I read that, it sealed the deal that I had to do this. I had to cover him, because I would love to see that, and I basically watch every Marx Brothers movie so many times, I'm like sort of seeking out weird other footage and other stuff that those guys did, so uh-huh. I would love to see what that was like, because I mean, Chico is an amazing musician, and I love his little piano skits that he does in the movies and such. So yeah, I would be really intrigued. I guess he spotted him, saw that he could play bass and violin, and was like, I need that guy, you know, or whatever Chico would do.
Well, he goes off to World War II, joins the Coast Guard, comes back to Chicago in 51, and he begins this really successful run as a session bassist. So, again, he was playing on records like of Sinatra, Mahalia Jackson, just, again, amazing names that he's played with.
I would venture to say he did a little bit of everything. I mean, he hung out in New York a little bit before he came here and played in a trio and wrote like a jazz standard, basically Detour Ahead. And he had like a residency. He was on a country swing show as well, a fairly popular country swing radio show. So I think he was just one of those guys that could, you know, kind of do it all, you know, like, you know, and like we were saying, sort of a Renaissance man. He wrote poetry. He did visual art. Just a really amazing dude.
So there's a little bit of a WGN connection here. He is playing with the house band Sage Riders. The Sage Riders were originally on WLS, National Barn Dance, from 51 to 1960. That comes to GN, though, GN Radio in 61. And he's playing... he composed, this is amazing, he composed and arranged the Chicago Cubs fight song, Hey, Hey, Holy Mackerel. I mean, what?
In 1969, I know. And that gig with the Sage Riders for WGN lasted for 14 more years. Yeah, and he's, I really like this early 70s country rock band from Chicago, Mason Prophet. Kind of sounds like the Byrds, sort of country rock period. They actually even had kind of like something resembling a local hit called Two Hangmen that he plays on one of their records too. So he was like basically dabbling in like ultra hip country rock quarters, you know, while also playing old timey country, while also playing jazz, and while writing Cubs fight songs, I guess too, you know, and appearing on the Tonight Show in Johnny Carson in the '80s too.
Yeah, 1988, he does that, and so he's been playing bass for so long, a huge part of his career, but he comes back to the violin here in Chicago, especially, and he is playing a lot in the jazz sort of world around Chicago, playing the violin, and that's towards the end of his life.
I mean, it's funny because, yeah, it's like he pretty much made the full switch to violin, yeah, in the 80s, the late 80s. And then he basically recorded like more or less his first solo record in the 90s. And I mean, he just passed in 2007. I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, I guess we're talking almost 15 years ago now, but had a long life. It did a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he lived to age 90. That is a good run.
Yeah.
And he did a lot. He packed a lot in there, and you can get the entire story of Johnny Frigo at chicagoreader.com in the Secret History of Chicago Music strip, and you even have a hand-drawn picture of Mr. Johnny Frigo, who, again, was, I mean, how often can you say this? Like a violin shredder. That's awesome.
Which we put up, you know, these days we've been embedding a fair amount of tracks in with the strips too. So if I'm not mistaken, my editor put in a video of him playing at the Green Mill, I think in the 2000s, and he is just killing it. I really wish I would have gone. There's a few people, especially at the Green Mill, who I would, you know, old timers, I wish I would have gone and seen in the old days.
Well, the music lives on. Steve Krakow is the author of the Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader online at chicagoreader.com. Steve, it is always a pleasure speaking with you, sir. You stay safe out there and keep just shredding at life. Here we are in September and school is back in session. And almost exactly 2 years ago on this show, I talked to Rita Oseguera, who is a freelance reporter. And at the time, she wrote a piece for ChicagoReporter.com called How Low Expectations Force Low-Income Students to Miss Out on College Aid. We had an interesting conversation, and this is what it sounds like. You focus this piece on East Aurora High School in Aurora, Illinois. So what I'd like you to do just at the outset here, when we say low expectations, if you could just briefly explain what this issue here is when we're saying that people are having low expectations for students when they're leaving high school.
Yeah, so what I meant by low expectations was that a lot of the counselors at the school were pushing students to go more towards public school colleges and community colleges instead of pushing them to kind of reach their full potential and go to more private universities or elite colleges. And a lot of these students that I spoke with were of the top 10. So they definitely had the grades and the capabilities to go to those type of colleges.
So it's important for context here that when we talk about the community that East Aurora High School is in, we're talking about a lot of immigrants. It's a high minority population, right?
Yes, correct.
And so when we think about a school that is in this situation, and there are many schools that are in this kind of area, when we talk about low expectations here, we're thinking about things like counselors aren't, like you say, pushing students to apply for maybe the bigger schools where maybe they could get more money, or they're not really helping the students navigate the system because the college application process is not a straightforward and simple process. There's a lot that you have to know there. And the students that you spoke to for this piece, a lot of them, sort of the theme that I picked up here was that they were just lost, or it felt like they were forgotten about.
Yes, that's exactly right. And a lot of the problem isn't even the counselor's fault, but there's just their focus is on graduation rather than college. So they have to focus on getting them to graduate, or they have other like behavioral issues they have to focus on. And then all the work of college falls on one counselor that is focused on career development. And then a lot of the teachers actually take on the role as counselors, and they help their students in their classes, and they give them resources that might help them.
Again, this is a low-income community. You say a family of four making $71,300 a year in the Chicago, Joliet, Naperville area is considered low-income, and this school population is 72% low-income. And it's also the families, because you might say to yourself, well, how come the parents aren't more involved or the families aren't more involved? Mm-hmm. The families don't know the system either. And, you know, it's kind of like this game of school, we might call it, that you have to know who to talk to. This is a big school, like many of the schools are these days. And it's an issue also of the families sort of being lost in this.
Yeah, and a lot of them in the story, I say a lot of them don't have a college degree, but a lot of them don't even have a high school degree, and they don't understand how the educational system here in the U.S. works. A lot of them in this area are Mexican immigrants, and they don't understand the language or the system. And a part of it also is that since they're low income, these parents are also working two or three jobs, and they come home really tired. It's hard to educate yourself in a system you don't know about, in a language you don't know about, when you're already so tired from working so much as well.
And again, we want to think about just sort of big picture here, why this all matters. It's really, for me, you know, I look at this and I think, like a lot of other people would say, obviously we want students to do well and be at their full potential and really feel like they've been equipped with the knowledge to go forward for the next step, if it's college or if it's trade school or if it's going into the workforce. And it seems like the system overall might not be doing the greatest job in terms of not letting students fall through the cracks. And I know that education is a huge system in this country, but this is a real problem. We're talking about human lives here. And I got to ask the question, you know, why the system is the way that it is. Why do we have, you know, expectations for one group of students that are at one level and a different set of expectations for another level? Did you sort of get to the heart of that at all with this piece?
I think a part of it just comes down to resources. And the former counselor I spoke with, he works at a Geneva community high school. And he spoke a lot about how he had resources and the counselor had extra training on career advancement for students. They would go to seminars or conferences. And at East, he said that was something that wasn't offered because they don't have the money to pay for that kind of things, for that kind of training for counselors. And they're just more well equipped to help the students succeed. And the counselors at East are not because they don't have the resources. And it kind of hurts the students the most, even though the counselors at East are trying their best, but they don't have the amount of people that they need. They don't have the equipped training that they need, and it just hurts the students.
Again, that clip from September 2019 here on Outside the Loop. That's Rita Oseguera, freelance reporter. She wrote a piece for ChicagoReporter.com called How Low Expectations Force Low-Income Students to Miss Out on College Aid. A really interesting conversation. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 778 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Colin for producing. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. Have a fantastic week, and I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.